the children had left it, as if time had stopped the night they died. I went from room to room, examining their contents like an archaeologist. There were wooden toys moldering in a box, crayons on a windowsill, their colors dulled by the light of 10,000 afternoons, a dollhouse with dolls inside, lifers in an ornate prison. In a modest library, the creep of moisture had bowed the shelves into crooked smiles. I ran my finger along the balding spines, as if considering pulling one out to read. There were classics like Peter Pan and The Secret Garden, histories written by authors forgotten by history, textbooks of Latin and Greek. In the corner were corralled a few old desks. This had been their classroom, I realized, and Miss Peregrine, their teacher. I tried to open a pair of heavy doors, twisting the handle, but they were swelled shut, so I took a running start and rammed them with my shoulder. They flew open with a rasping shriek, and I fell face first into the next room. As I picked myself up and looked around, I realized that it could only have belonged to Miss Peregrine. It was like a room in Sleeping Beauty's castle, with cobwebbed candles mounted in wall sconces, a mirrored vanity table topped with crystal bottles, and a giant oak bed. I pictured the last time she'd been here, scrambling out from under the sheets in the middle of the night to the whine of an air raid siren, rounding up the children, all groggy and grasping for coats on their way downstairs. "Were you scared?" I wondered. "Did you hear the planes coming?" I began to feel unusual. I imagined I was being watched, that the children were still here, preserved like the bog boy, inside the walls. I could feel them peering at me through cracks and knotholes. I drifted into the next room. Weak light shone through a window. Petals of powder blue wallpaper drooped toward a couple of small beds, still clad in dusty sheets. I knew, somehow, that this had been my grandfather's room. "Why did you send me here? What was it you needed me to see?" Then I noticed something beneath one of the beds and knelt down to look. It was an old suitcase. "Was this yours? Is it what you carried onto the train the last time you saw your mother and father as your first life was slipping away?" I pulled it out and fumbled with its tattered leather straps. It opened easily, but except for a family of dead beetles, it was empty. I felt empty too, and strangely heavy, like the planet was spinning too fast, heating up gravity, pulling me toward the floor. Suddenly exhausted, I sat on the bed, his bed, maybe, and for reasons I can't quite explain, I stretched out on those filthy sheets and stared at the ceiling. "What did you think about lying here at night? Did you have nightmares too?" I began to cry. "When your parents died, did you know it? Could you feel them go?" I cried harder. I didn't want to, but I couldn't stop myself. I couldn't stop myself, so I thought about all the bad things and I fed it and fed it until I was crying so hard I had to gasp for breath between sobs. I thought about how my great-grandparents had starved to death. I thought about their wasted bodies being fed to incinerators because people they didn't know hated them. I thought about how the children who lived in this house had been burned up and blown apart because a pilot who didn't care pushed a button. I thought about how my grandfather's family had been taken from him, and how because of that my dad grew up feeling like he didn't have a dad. And now, I had acute stress and nightmares and was sitting alone in a falling down house and crying hot, stupid tears all over my shirt. All because of a 70-year-old hurt that had somehow been passed down to me like some poisonous heirloom and monsters I couldn't fight because they were all dead, beyond killing or punishing or any kind of reckoning. At least my grandfather had been able to join the army and go fight them. What could I do? When it was over, my head was pounding. I closed my eyes and pushed my knuckles in to stop them from hurting, if only for a moment, and when I finally released the pressure and opened them again, a miraculous change had come over the room. There was a single ray of sun shining through the window. I got up, went to the cracked glass, and saw that it was both raining and shining outside, a bit of meteorological weirdness whose name no one can seem to agree on. My mom, I kid you not, refers to it as orphan's tears. Then I remembered what Ricky says about it. The devil's beaten his wife, and I laughed and felt a little better. Then, in the patch of quickly fading sun that fell across the room, I noticed something I hadn't before. It was a trunk, or the edge of one at least, poking out from under the second bed. I went over and peeled back the bedsheet that hid most of it from view. It was a big, old steamer trunk latched with a giant rusting padlock. It couldn't possibly be empty, I thought. You don't lock an empty trunk. Open me, it fairly seemed to cry out. I am full of secrets. I grabbed it by the sides and pulled. It didn't move. I pulled again, harder, but it wouldn't give an inch. I wasn't sure if it was just that heavy, or if generations of accumulated moisture and dust had somehow fused it to the floor. I stood up and kicked it a few times, which seemed to jar things loose, and then I managed to move it by pulling on one side at a time, shimmying it forward the way you might move a stove or a fridge, until it had come out all the way from under the bed, leaving a trail of parenthetical scars in the floor. I yanked on the padlock, but despite a thick encrustation of rust, it seemed rock solid. I briefly considered searching for a key. It had to be here somewhere, but I could have wasted hours looking, and the lock was so decayed that I wondered if the key would even work anymore. My only option was to break it. Looking around for something that might do the job, I found a busted chair in one of the other rooms. I pried off a leg and went to town on the lock, raising the leg over my head like an executioner and bringing it down as hard as I could, over and over, until the leg itself finally broke and I was left holding a splintered stump. I scanned the room for something stronger and quickly spotted a loose railing on the bed frame. After a few stomping kicks, it clattered to the floor. I wedged one end through the lock and pulled the other end backward. Nothing happened. I hung on it with all my weight, lifting my feet off the floor like I was doing a pull-up with the rail. The trunk creaked a little, but that was it. I started to get mad. I kicked the trunk and pulled on that rail with every bit of my strength, the veins bulging out of my neck, yelling, "Open, goddamn you! Open, you stupid trunk!" Finally, my frustration and anger had an object. If I could make my dead grandfather give up his secrets, I would damn well pry the secrets out of this old trunk. And then the rail slipped, and I crashed to the floor and got the wind knocked out of me. I lay there and stared at the ceiling, catching my breath. The orphan's tears had ended, and now it was just plain old raining outside, harder than ever. I thought about going back to town for a sledgehammer or a hacksaw, but that would only raise questions I didn't feel like answering. Then I had a brilliant idea. If I could find a way to break the trunk, I wouldn't have to worry about the lock at all. And what force would be stronger than me and my admittedly underdeveloped upper body muscles wailing on the trunk with random tools? Gravity. I was, after all, on the second floor of the house, and while I didn't think there was any way I could lift the trunk high enough to get it through a window, the rail along the top of the staircase landing had long ago collapsed. All I had to do was drag the trunk down the hall and push it over. Whether its contents would survive the impact was another issue, but at least I'd find out what was inside. I hunkered down behind the trunk and began pushing it toward the hall. After a few inches, its metal feet dug into the soft floor and it ground stubbornly to a halt. Undeterred, I moved around to the other side, gripped the padlock with both hands, and pulled backward. To my great surprise, it moved 2 or 3 feet in one go. It wasn't a particularly dignified way of working, this squatting, butt-scooting motion I had to repeat over and over, each slide of the trunk accompanied by an ear-splitting metal-on-wood shriek. But before long, I'd gotten it out of the room and was dragging it, foot by foot, doorway by doorway, toward the landing. I lost myself in the echoing rhythm of it, working up a manly lather of sweat in the process. I finally made it to the landing and, with one final and delicate grunt, pulled the trunk onto it after me. It slid easily now, and after a few more shoves, I had it teetering precariously on the edge. One last nudge would be enough to send it over, but I wanted to see it shatter, my reward for all this work. So I got up and carefully shuffled toward the edge until I could glimpse the floor of the gloomy chamber below. Then, holding my breath, I gave the trunk a little tap with my foot. It hesitated for a moment, wobbling there on the edge of oblivion, and then pitched decisively forward and fell, tumbling end over end in beautiful balletic slow motion. There came a tremendous echoing crash that seemed to rattle the whole house as a plume of dust shot up at me from below, and I had to cover my face and retreat down the hall until it cleared. A minute later, I came back and peeked again over the landing and saw not the pile of smashed wood that I had so fondly hoped for, but a jagged trunk-shaped hole in the floorboards. It had fallen straight through into the basement. I raced downstairs and wriggled up to the edge of the buckled floor on my belly like you would a hole in thin ice. 15 feet below, through a haze of dust and darkness, I saw what remained of the trunk. It had shattered like a giant egg, its pieces all mixed up in a heap of debris and smashed floorboards. Scattered throughout were little pieces of paper. It looked like I'd found a box of letters, after all. But then, squinting, I could make out shapes on them, faces, bodies, and that's when I realized they weren't letters at all, but photographs. Dozens of them. I got excited, and then, just as quickly, went cold, because something dreadful occurred to me. I have to go down there. The basement was a meandering complex of rooms so lightless, I may as well have explored them blindfolded. I descended the creaking stairs and stood at the bottom for a while, hoping my eyes would eventually adjust, but it was the kind of dark there was no adjusting to. I was hoping I'd get used to the smell, a strange, acrid stink like the supply closet in a chemistry classroom, but no such luck. So I shuffled in with my shirt collar pulled up over my nose and my hands held out in front of me, and hoped for the best. I tripped and nearly fell. Something made of glass went skidding away across the floor. The smell only seemed to get worse. I began to imagine things lurking in the dark ahead of me. Forget monsters and ghosts. What if there was another hole in the floor? They'd never find my body. Then I realized, in a minor stroke of genius, that by dialing up a menu screen on the cell phone I kept in my pocket, despite being 10 miles from the nearest bar of reception, I could make a weak flashlight. I held it out, aiming the screen away from me. It barely penetrated the darkness, so I pointed it at the floor. Cracked flagstone and mouse turds. I aimed it to the side. A faint gleam reflected back. I took a step closer and swept my phone around. Out of the darkness emerged a wall of shelves lined with glass jars. They were all shapes and sizes, mottled with dust and filled with gelatinous-looking things suspended in cloudy fluid. I thought of the kitchen and the exploded jars of fruits and vegetables I'd found there. Maybe the temperature was more stable down here, and that's why these had survived. But then I got closer still and looked a little harder and realized they weren't fruits and vegetables at all, but organs, brains, hearts, lungs, eyes, all pickled in some kind of home-brewed formaldehyde, which explained the terrific stench. I gagged and stumbled away from them into the dark, simultaneously grossed out and baffled. What kind of place was this? Those jars were something you might expect to find in the basement of a fly-by-night medical school, not a house full of children. If not for all the wonderful things Grandpa Portman had said about this place, I might have wondered if Miss Peregrine had rescued the children just to harvest their organs. When I'd recovered a little, I looked up to see another gleam ahead of me. Not a reflection of my phone, but a weak glimmer of daylight. It had to be coming from the hole I'd made. I soldiered on, breathing through my pulled-up shirt and keeping away from the walls and any other ghastly surprises they might have harbored. The gleam led me around a corner and into a small room with part of the ceiling caved in. Daylight streamed through the hole onto a mound of splintered floorboards and broken glass from which rose coils of silty dust, pieces of torn carpet plastered here and there like scraps of desiccated meat. Beneath the debris, I could hear the scrabble of tiny feet, some rodentine dark dweller that had survived the implosion of its world. In the midst of it all lay the demolished trunk, photographs scattered around it like confetti. I picked my way through the wreckage, high-stepping javelins of wood and plank studded with rusting nails. Kneeling, I began to salvage what I could from the pile. I felt like a rescue worker, plucking faces from the debris, brushing away glass and wood rot, and though part of me wanted to hurry, there was no telling if or when the rest of the floor might collapse on my head, I couldn't stop myself from studying them. At first glance, they looked like the kind of pictures you'd find in any old family album. There were shots of people cavorting on beaches and smiling on back porches, vistas from around the island, and lots of kids posing in singles and pairs. Informal snapshots and formal portraits taken in front of backdrops, their subjects clutching dead-eyed dolls like they'd gone to glamour shots in some creepy turn-of-the-century shopping mall. But what I found really creepy wasn't the zombie dolls or the children's weird haircuts or how they never, ever seemed to smile, but that the more I studied the pictures, the more familiar they began to seem. They shared a certain nightmarish quality with my grandfather's old photos, especially the ones he'd kept hidden in the bottom of his cigar box, as if somehow they'd all come from the same batch. There was, for instance, a photo of two young women posed before a not terribly convincing painted backdrop of the ocean. Not so strange in and of itself, the unsettling thing was how they were posed. Both had their backs to the camera. Why would you go to all the trouble and expense of having your picture taken, portraits were pricey back then, and then turn your back on the camera? I half expected to find another photo in the debris of the same girls facing forward, revealing grinning skulls for faces. Other pictures seemed manipulated in much the same way as some of my grandfather's had been. One was of a lone girl in a cemetery staring into a reflecting pool, but two girls were reflected back. It reminded me of Grandpa Portman's photo of the girl trapped in a bottle, only whatever darkroom technique that had been used wasn't nearly as fake-looking. Another was of a disconcertingly calm young man whose upper body appeared to be swarming with bees. That would be easy enough to fake, right? Like my grandfather's picture of the boy lifting what was certainly a boulder made of plaster. Fake rock, fake bees. The hairs on the back of my neck stood up as I remembered something Grandpa Portman had said about a boy he'd known here in the children's home. A boy with bees living inside him. Some would fly out every time he opened his mouth, he had said, but they never stung unless Hugh wanted them to. I could think of only one explanation. My grandfather's pictures had come from the trunk that lay smashed before me. I wasn't certain, though, until I found a picture of the freaks, two masked ruffle-collared kids who seemed to be feeding each other a coil of ribbon. I didn't know what they were supposed to be, exactly. Besides fuel for nightmares, what were they? Sadomasochistic ballerinas? but there was no doubt in my mind that Grandpa Portman had a picture of these same two boys. I'd seen it in a cigar box just a few